You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by the MLB.com Shop.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach, talking National League East, where it's been a little quieter than over in the AL, but there's certainly been some very interesting stuff going on. We'll be talking Miami Marlins and the enormous deal they just made and where they go from there. We'll be talking the kind of frisky New York Mets, who are definitely thinking about contention next year. We'll be talking about the reigning division champion Washington Nationals and whether they're going to trade away a big piece. Talking about the big move that the Atlanta Braves made and where they go from there. We'll be talking about the always intriguing Phillies, who have a lot of trade options and a lot of possibilities and still not quite sure where they're going yet. So thanks for listening, everybody, to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach, talking Washington Nationals with MLB.com's Nationals beat reporter Bill Ladson. Bill, it's been a fairly quiet start to the offseason for the Nationals, but there's one potentially big name that keeps getting bounced around. It's appeared again today. Where do you think things stand with Jordan Zimmermann, a guy whose name is suddenly appearing once in a while in trade rumors?
Well, I find it hard to believe they're going to sign him to an extension. And it would not surprise me if they try to trade him. Now, I saw the report from Bob Nightingale where the Nationals are putting it out there that he's available. So it wouldn't surprise me. I just think that it's a matter of money because they did offer him a contract, a five-year deal, and he turned it down. So it's going to be interesting how things go. I think they're going to trade him, to be honest.
What kind of deal would they be looking at doing if they were to part with a guy who is such a central part of what they've done the last few years?
I would think, obviously, knowing the Nationals, since Rizzo has been the GM, I think they would look for prospects, obviously, pitching in particular, maybe a couple of hitters, but I would think it would be mostly pitching in return.
So you would expect this to be, and again, I realize we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves to some extent, but you would anticipate this would be something for the farm system, for financial relief, and not necessarily the kind of deal where maybe you get deal off your Major League roster to upgrade the Major League roster?
At this point, I don't see it. I mean, it could be, but I just don't see it. And I don't see it as, you know, financial release because the Nationals are not willing to cut payroll. I mean, they want to get better. They want to be a world championship team. So I just think personally that it's a matter of, getting more for the farm system than anything else.
As they explore a potential long-term deal with Zimmermann, as you know, that's something that's at least come up already, do you get the impression that they are far apart, or is it just a matter of you kind of can't take that risk and let a guy that good get to free agency and risk not getting anything if he walks?
Well, just based on the last couple of years, I think they have to be far apart because, you know, Zimmermann has gone on record to say he's not taking the team a discount, so I have to think that they're far apart because they've been trying to get an extension for him for the last 3 years, and it hasn't happened. So, as you know, he took a two-year deal last year. So, I think right now they have to be far apart.
Do you get the impression that this is something that might be sooner than later, or do you just think that whenever a name like that comes up, it's something that all of us in the baseball media are going to seize on?
Well, knowing Mike Rizzo is going to take his time, he's going to get the right deal, I think it'll take a while before a deal gets done. And, it depends. I mean, the way Mike Rizzo makes deals, it wouldn't surprise me if he asked for a king's ransom. So it's going to take a while.
Meanwhile, there is the business of actually building the 2015 Nationals, and they're a club with a lot of prominent, and or at least a couple of prominent noteworthy free agents of their own. Do you see any movement with any of those guys, or do you anticipate that pretty much all of the Nationals' own free agents are out the door?
Well, I think they're going to try to keep Ian Desmond. I know Ian Desmond wants to stay a National. He really does. And I think in my, deep down, I think he will get signed. Duck Sister is another guy I think he could possibly get signed. He really likes in Washington. I think he could get signed. Tyler Clippard, I've said all along, I think he's going to be traded. I think he's due to make a lot of money, and the time is to trade him now than later. So I think he will not be a National by the time the 2015 season comes around.
Saw a very interesting stat on him, noting the really heavy workload that he's had over the last few years. As good as he has been, beyond the contract concerns, is there any worry, any idea that maybe you trade him a year too early rather than a year too late, just in that you put that many miles on a reliever? Is there any worry that maybe that workload starts to catch up with him at some point?
Well, it wouldn't surprise me if Mike Rizzo thought that way. I have not talked to Mike Rizzo regarding Kyle Clipper. But one thing that Tyler Clipper does during spring training, that he starts off slow, meaning, you know, he doesn't throw as much during spring training because he knows, like, during the season he's going to see a lot of work. So he really tries his best to get things done early in the season than later.
As far as the process of building this next year's Nationals, where do you see this club right now in the free agent market? Do you see them moving towards any sort of intriguing additions, or is most of what's going to happen with this club going to be internal?
Well, you know, it depends. As far as second base is concerned, you know, they're really thinking about going with Danny Espinosa again, you know, making him just hit right-handed. Whether that happens, that remains to be seen. It wouldn't surprise me if they did go in the free agent market. I mean, Jed Lowry is out there. It wouldn't surprise me if they went out and got another reliever. Andrew Miller's out there. He could really help the bullpen from the left side. So I will never underestimate Mike Rizzo. I mean, he's hard to read at times, but I think he will go after a player like Andrew Miller.
Can you see them spending big? I mean, they obviously did it a couple of years ago. Can you see them again spending big on a reliever with what it seems like it's going to take to get Miller?
I could see it possibly. I, you know, nothing surprised me when it comes to the Nationals. If you asked me this question 5 years ago, I would have said no way. But you know, with Mike Rizzo there, I can see it happening.
There are all kinds of rumors about Adam LaRoche swirling and who's interested in him. Obviously, it's kind of been a foregone conclusion for a while that the Nationals weren't going to bring him back. But do you have any read on where he might end up, assuming it's not Washington?
I got to tell you, if he goes to the Florida Marlins, at least Miami Marlins, I think that would be a good fit. I mean, he would provide the leadership that they are looking for. Obviously, they have Stanton, but you add LaRoche there, he could really make that clubhouse great. I have to say, I mean, I already know about the offer the Marlins have made, but he would be a great addition there. That's the only team I know that has offered him any kind of deal, but it would be a great addition if they added LaRoche.
And to go back just a little bit to Jordan Zimmermann, do you feel like if they were to move him, again, talking about the 2015 Nationals, do you feel like if they were to move him, they would be satisfied with what they had in their rotation, or would that then lead to them maybe looking to add another starting pitcher?
Well, Matthew, based on what I heard earlier in the couple weeks ago, the Nationals are confident that they have the pitching to replace Jordan Zimmermann right now. They are confident in Blake Treinen. When he was given a chance, he really pitched well. There was just no room in that rotation last year. You can't forget a guy by the name of A.J. Cole. A.J. Cole also has a chance to be in that rotation. And in his brief time last spring training, he was impressive. So I don't think the Nationals are worried about who can replace Jordan Zimmermann. I don't think they need to get another veteran like a Max Scherzer or anything like that. I think they have it in place. I think what they really need right now is add maybe another hitter to that lineup. And that's what they need to really go after.
If that's not at second base, how or where does that upgrade to the offense happen?
Well, I mean, I think they have no choice. It has to be at second base because that's where the hole is. And because, you know, we know that Rendon's going to be at third and Desmond at short, and first base is going to be Ryan Zimmermann. So it's going to have to be someone at second base. I don't think Cabrera's coming back either. That's a money issue there. I don't think he's going to get top dollar from the Nationals anyway, not for what he did last year. And I think it depends on who they can get via trade or even free agency.
All right. Well, Bill Ladson, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Atlanta Braves with MLB.com's Braves beat reporter Mark Bowman. Mark, the Braves made, to me, one of the more surprising and interesting trades I've seen in quite a while here recently. And it looks like it might not be the last thing they do, but let's start with what they actually did. It had to be tough for them to part with Jason Hayward, who is not only a really good player, but a homegrown, hometown guy, even with the knowledge that it might have been difficult to sign him. How difficult was it for the organization to pull the trigger on a move like that?
There's no doubt there's some difficulty there. As you said, this is a kid that everyone has known, especially within the organization, since he was drafted directly out of high school and made the 20-minute drive to Turner Field that day. And, you know, he was going to be the, you know, he has been recognized as the guy who was going to be maybe the next Chipper Jones, the next face of the organization, recognized in that light since he was 18 years old. He burst on the scene at the major league level at the age of 20, made an all-star, maybe all-star team that year. Actually, was 11. Selected, voted to be a starter that year. You know, obviously he has not lived up to the expectations that maybe people would have set at that time over the next 5 years. He's still very young, still going to play the most of his upcoming season at 25. This kid has a lot of potential, and we know what he can do with the glove. He's got two gold gloves, and his attitude that he brings to the park every day is great. He's a kid that's easy to pull for, but at the same time, when you look at the economics of the game, the likelihood that the Braves are going to be comfortable offering what Jason, you know, might end up getting, you know, the $100 million plus contract next year as a free agent, they saw an opportunity to move him and fill a definite need there in the starting rotation. And I think they did this is a deal that you know, you hear, you know, every so often, this is certainly a deal that works for both clubs. St. Louis feels an immediate need. The Braves feel a definite need on an immediate basis, and also improve their future. Like you said, it's tough to say goodbye to Jason, but this deal made a lot of sense.
Hayward is a really intriguing player to me because he has not put up gaudy offensive numbers, and yet because of his all-around game is really an excellent player. He's you know, you mentioned the defense. He's a terrific base runner. He gets on base even when he doesn't put up big power numbers or hit for average. Do you think that even as good as he is, if the offensive numbers, or even if he were the same quality player but it looked different, if he were driving in runs, if he were a high average hitter, do you think that this is this would all look different if he had put up bigger offensive numbers? I guess what I'm asking is, do you think they would have been more willing to kind of make that commitment and lock him up and pay whatever it took if he were a different kind of player and if he were more of a traditional middle-of-the-lineup big bat guy?
I do, and I remember having a couple conversations near the end of the season with his representative, and, you kind of just go back and forth, and I said, yeah, I understand the potential is there for him to get the money that he's hoping to get. The one thing that would scare you away is the power really has only been there the one season. In 2012, he hit 27 home runs. He stole 21 bases. The next year, he had an appendectomy, and his face was shattered with the John East fastball. He missed a month with both of those unavoidable ailments, so his numbers weren't, you know, where you expect them to be. He had a great growth break before getting hit with that pitch. You saw that tremendous potential again. But all in all, you take last season and then this season when he was relatively healthy the whole year, he still has not matched the home run total from 2012. The power has not been there. The stolen bases, I think he's got one more stolen base over the last two seasons that he did there in 2012. You haven't seen it, the consistency that you want to see out of Jason, and I think that is why last year when the Braves decided who they were going to give the big-time, long-term contract to. It was an easy decision to give it to Freeman instead of Hayward. And at the time, there were people that said, you know, look, they chose Freeman instead of Hayward. And I think they were right. If Jason had continued to do what he did in 2012, or maybe even just the first 6 weeks of the 2010 season when he caught the baseball world by storm, if he continued on those, you know, with that progression, yeah, he might have been the guy that had the long-term future here. Or maybe they would have been able to find a way to get been more flexible, make more of an attempt to try to lock both Freeman and Hayward up. Right now, I don't, you know, they're not in a financial situation where they could do that. But here in the next couple of years, as they move towards a new stadium, yeah, they could be in that position. But Hayward just has not shown enough consistency at the plate over the years to warrant the kind of money that he's hoping to get next year. And there's a chance he does get it. I mean, if he comes out and has a big season in St. Louis this year, he will get it. But right now, I just don't think the Braves were a team that's been able to watch him every day, more comfortable, taking a chance of basically only getting a draft pick for him if he did not live up to that potential this year.
So let's talk about the other half of the deal and a guy that, you know, obviously I've watched for a long time in Shelby Miller, and to me a really interesting pitcher. I drew comparisons to Matt Cain when he was coming up as a potential really good two or even borderline number one starter. And it's kind of been there in fits and starts, but it hasn't been there consistently. Do the Braves think that there is a lot more to be tapped in Miller? Do they think there's a better pitcher there than he has shown, and that maybe he still could be the guy that he was projected to be a couple years ago?
Yeah, I think John Hart put it well the other day when just asked about saying, look, this is the guy. I think my question to him was basically, you know, this is the guy who could be a top of the rotation guy. And immediately he said, well, right now he's middle of the rotation. You know, with a guy that has a chance to develop into whether it's a solid number two or a potential number one. I think one thing that when you look at Shelby's numbers, you look at the beginning of the 2013 season, then he had a little bit of a rough stretch there during the latter part of the season, kind of turned it around. Again, this year there was a little couple bumps in the road there during the middle of the season. You see how he finished the season. You hear him talk about how he developed the two-seam fastball, got away from being a four-seam guy who was more of a thrower than a pitcher, and he's saying all the right things. And you get that feeling. I know we haven't got to see him pitch on a consistent basis, but he's saying all the right things, and he sounds like a pitcher, and we all know how talented he is. Now, here's a guy, if he can – he can use that four-seamer as a weapon and pitch off that two-seamer, continue to learn how to approach hitters in the way that he did while talking to Adam Wainwright, Justin Masterson, guys that have had an influence on him during his early part of his career. If he can continue to do that here in Atlanta, yeah, he can develop into a guy who he and Julio Teheran would consider the top of that rotation over the next 4 years.
And as much as we've broken this down, to me, and I think you feel this as well, the most interesting thing about this deal is what's next. The Braves were close to a playoff spot last year, but it is now looking like maybe you don't want to use the word rebuilding because I don't think they're tearing it up, but that maybe they have a little more eye to a year or two down the road. One, do you think that's accurate? And two, if so, what does that look like as far as the transactions they make?
Yeah, I do think that I think they are keeping open the possibility that if some of these deals that they will end up making, primarily the two significant moves that they can make could be trading Justin Upton or Evan Gattis or possibly both, which I'm kind of leaning towards the latter. I think that they can gain a significant return for both. It would help them probably more for the future. Like I said, they're keeping open the possibility that they might be able to compete in 2015, but there just were too many needs within this organization. So when you step back and say, okay, this team's only 1 year removed from a 96-win season, you know, a division crown, I guess they had a disappointing year this year. But if you took a step back and looked at the fact that they basically had three major league-ready starters to carry into next season before they got Shelby Miller, now they have four within their system. You look at their farm system. It has been rated as one of the game's worst here this year. Now, all of a sudden, this week, they went and they got Arodis Vizcaino. They got Tyrell Jenkins. Both of these guys now fit into MLB.com's top 10 list for the club. You're starting to see them, like I said, address that immediate need for starting pitching with Shelby Miller, start to improve this farm system, add some arms that will have an impact over the next few years. And, you know, we all know that this team, while you want to win every year, they definitely want to have some consistency, the ability to have consistent success once they move into this new stadium in 2017. So I think that is their primary focus. If there are some moves, some of these moves bring some returns to create financial flexibility or just direct return with the players that allow them to compete next year, then fine. You know that they will. But I think the eye has to be towards replenishing that farm system and setting yourself up to win on a consistent basis from 2016 on.
If they are to do that, and if those are the kind of moves that that we're looking at here, and in particular moves of Gattis and Upton, what do you think they would be looking for just as far as the shape of the talent? Is this one of those cases where it's all about as many arms as possible, or is there also going to be some eye towards getting some offensive pieces for in the next playoff Braves team, whether that's in 15 or 16 or 17?
Yeah, I think they are going to have to. They feel a lot better now that they got Shelby Miller and Tyrell Jenkins. They will continue to try to add another couple arms, but as they move forward, I think we're going to see outfield as a focus. You look at their system, they've got Jose Peraza coming, a second baseman that can fill in there. Maybe at some point next year they put him on the 40-man roster. He's only got 40 games above the A-ball level, so my guess is he will not be deemed major league ready on opening day. That remains to be seen, but they feel like they have that. They obviously are set at catcher, first base, shortstop, and they've got Chris Johnson at third base. So, you know, they'll see there could be some movement there or some adjustment there at some point. But in the outfield, they really do not have anything for the future. So I think that's where we will see the next wave or the next emphasis with some of the trades they make. They will try to grab a couple young outfielders who could be in that lineup, at any point within the next couple of years.
All right. Well, Mark Bowman, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras, talking New York Mets with Mets broadcaster Howie Rose. And it's been an interesting offseason already for the Mets, perhaps more so than people expected in the early going. The biggest development, obviously, was the signing of Michael Kadire, and I had some inclination earlier in the winter that the Mets would be particularly hesitant to part with a draft pick, even for a star player, and they go and make that move. Was it surprising at all to you that they were willing to make that decision, or was it just so necessary to get that bat that it was understandable regardless?
Mildly surprising, Matthew, and good to be with you. I think that there is a feeling within the organization that it's time. It's time to take that next step. And at this point, I don't think there was a lot of patience for what was going to be 3 or 4 years down the road in all likelihood, meaning the time frame before you'd get any real production out of that first-round pick. There are some good live arms in this organization. Some other good young players have started to make an imprint. And so the feeling, I think, organization-wide is strap it on. We're in business. It's all about winning now.
Is that urgency self-generated? Is that just something they've decided, or is that in any way a result from any kind of external pressure, frustration among the fan base, that sort of thing?
Oh, I just think it's natural when you've had the kind of last half dozen years the Mets have that patience is bound to grow thin, and that's what's happened. Generally speaking, the fan base is going to find its patience a lot shorter than the organization's, because even though they all want to get to the same place, there are different agendas in terms of how to do that. But I think there's unanimity now in the feeling that enough losing, enough non-contending, every game's got to mean something in 2015 with the goal of playing in the postseason.
To what extent have the Mets kind of taken note of what's gone on around the division, and I mean particularly in Atlanta, and I certainly wouldn't rule out the Braves yet. Braves could have a very good ball club next year, but it seems like the Braves may be looking a couple of years down the road right now. The Phillies have acknowledged that they may be looking a couple of years down the road. The Marlins should be improved, but it looks like that there may be a little more of an opening within the division, that the division might be that. Might look a little different next year. Is that something that sort of has been taken note of within the Mets front office?
Parenthetically, I'm sure, but as a driving force towards doing whatever they are going to do this winter, never mind what they have already done, I think you have to have a certain degree of blinders on when it comes to that. Now, this is just my opinion, and general managers in various cities might well disagree, and I may be flat wrong on it, but I think when you are in a rebuilding mode, as the Mets have been, and in fact are coming out of that rebuilding mode, you know, you've got to be true to the plan, and you've got to do what basically has been your mindset from the beginning to develop these young players, get them ready to win, strengthen numbers as they certainly have or seem to have with pitching in particular, and I subscribe to that axiom that you never can have enough, and then when you feel you're ready to strike, go make your big hit, whether it's via free agency or trade, and if in fact that coincides with one or two other teams in the division taking a step back because they need to do something akin to, in the Mets' case, what they were starting to do several years ago, I'm sure that factors in a bit, but I think you've got to be mostly concerned with where your organization is at the present time, and if there is room to maneuver around a team or two that may be slip-sliding backwards, then fine, go for it.
What was it that made Michael Kadire the right fit for them at this time?
Versatility. Personality, not to be taken lightly, by the way, but I think the fact that he can play first base against a tough left-handed pitcher if the Mets want to give Lucas Duda a day or so off, that's a good thing. There's nothing wrong with that. I don't think that's the motivating force or anything close to it behind bringing him in. He's a strong, high-character guy. He has a relationship, of course, going back many, many years with David Wright, and David was pitching very hard for the organization to pursue and sign him, just as he was lobbying Michael Kadire to come to the Mets. I think he's a fit. He'll stretch their lineup. His numbers over the last 5 years on the road have been very good. I believe he's a .285 hitter the last 5 years away from home. And that's important when the last couple of years were played at Coors Field, because we all know how inflated, bloated, and distorted those numbers can be. But, you know, from all indications, the biggest and perhaps only real concern about Kadire is, can he stay healthy, given that he didn't even play 50 games last year, and how many games can he play at the age of 35 going on 36?
So with him in the fold, what's next? What does this team still want to accomplish? I mean, it does seem like that corner bat was really the one priority. They seem to maybe have still something of a surplus of starting pitching if they wanted to upgrade elsewhere. What do you think the next priorities are as they try to build the 2015 Mets?
I'll give you two. One, perhaps less of a priority now, if only because of what's out there, than it might have been conceptually or theoretically late in the season. That would be shortstop. And the other, which I think is a strong priority, is to add a left-handed arm in that bullpen. Josh Edgen has been there and had kind of an up-and-down year last year. He didn't make the club out of spring training, which was a disappointment. He's got good stuff, but they want to see the same sort of swash buckling mentality that Edgen brought with him to the big leagues a few years ago. For whatever reason, at times he's gotten away from that. And he's got the stuff when he's throwing at his peak velocity with a real good slider where you say, you know what, this guy can get lefties out consistently, should, and even get some right-handers out. But again, consistency is the key word with him. I think in a perfect world, they'd like a veteran left-handed reliever. Those things can be awfully expensive, as we just found out with Zach Duke. I don't think anybody expected 3 years and, what was it, $15 million for Zach Duke. But, you know, that can be prohibitive to most teams. And I don't think the Mets were going to go anywhere near that for a situational reliever. But I think that's clearly an area where they'd like to upgrade. Shortstop's intriguing because Wilmer Flores has a bat that's got a chance to play in the major leagues. His range, his ability at shortstop is certainly questionable. He was better than I think a lot of us were led to believe that he was going to be at the position when he played it last year. But I don't know that a team with championship aspirations can necessarily be comfortable with someone who has his limitations at shortstop. He can grow, though. He's doing a great job, even this offseason, so I'm made to understand from things I've read and heard, of streamlining his body even more, which he did last winter. This is a kid who really wants to succeed at the major league level and put the work in necessary to do that. And I think, you know, there will be a lot of discussion the rest of this offseason around the organization about which way to go. Do you bring in a shortstop? Is the right guy out there? Or do you give it to Flores and see if he can handle it?
Yeah, I mean, you kind of raised this yourself. The seems to me that the issue, as much as anything, is what's the alternative. And so I ask you that, as somebody who's kind of keeping an eye on this, if it's not Flores, what is the alternative as far as another shortstop option?
Internally, I don't think it's there yet. I don't think Ruben Tejada is going to be given an opportunity to win that job in spring training. I think he's had his chance. I think that, frankly, the organization might be a little disappointed in how he's approached his business over the last couple of years, and I think he's frankly played his way out of that position. Now, you've got a fellow named Matt Reynolds who had a tremendous year at both AA and AAA and has come a long way in a short time with a bat, but realistically, I don't think he'd be ready to be your everyday shortstop on opening day. So, you know, there could be two leap of faiths there. One, that Flores can handle the job. Two, that perhaps Reynolds might be able to grab it at some point during next season. I think right now, unless they were to go out and wait out someone who's a veteran in the free agent market and try to get him in a very team-friendly deal, a Stephen Drew, a Jed Lowry, then there's a pretty good chance they are going to go to spring training with Flores as the shortstop. If that's the case, I would think you'd want to have a real strong, solid defender to back him up in case you have a late innings lead. You might want to replace him. I don't think that person's in the organization just yet.
And do you get the impression, this is the impression I've gotten from talking to Anthony DeComo previously, do you get the impression that they're not inclined, I mean, the one surplus they do have is starting pitching. Do you get the impression, even in this, to some extent, win-now mode, that they would not be inclined to deal a starting pitcher in order to get that shortstop upgrade?
Well, you know, there are a couple of ways you could look at that, and I think one is under the supposition that the value, ironic as it is, that starting pitchers have always been looked at as perhaps the most precious commodity in all of baseball. I think that's perhaps changed a little bit, if only because of the tremendous amount of Tommy John surgeries that pitchers have gone through over the years, to the point where the starting pitching might be devalued a little bit because a general manager is always going to be wary of a guy who might break down or hasn't had his Tommy John yet, or sadly in several cases there have been some pitchers with multiple Tommy John surgeries. I'm not quite sure you can get what you used to be able to get for a starting pitcher, all things being equal. And they're not equal now, because what's happened over the years is that as the steroids era has ended and as things have gone back to reality as far as power is concerned, power numbers are down everywhere. That's the precious commodity in the game now. That's why Giancarlo Stanton was able to get the deal he did from the Miami Marlins of all teams. So I think the Mets might be hesitant on a couple of levels to trade starting pitching, but I think if you had to back me against a wall and say would they look to move one, I would say yes, and it would probably be either Jonathan Neese or Dylan G.
Gotcha. All right. Well, good stuff. Thanks very much for taking some time with us here on MLB.com Extras. Howie Rose, I appreciate the time. Talking Miami Marlins today with Marlins broadcaster Glenn Geffner. Glenn, thanks for taking some time to chat here.
You're with me, Matthew.
Obviously, there's one big, big story that dwarfs everything else around the Marlins right now. They came to terms on a deal that's either 13 or 6 years with Giancarlo Stanton, and there's a lot to kind of break down in it. I'm kind of interested in some of the specifics about the deal. For the club, how big a deal was committing to that no-trade clause to Stanton?
It's something they've been reluctant to do in the past, but I think what everybody acknowledges is that you're talking about a very unique talent. This is a once-in-a-lifetime talent. So, as they say, there are exceptions made to every rule. and I don't see much of an indication that the club is going to bend this rule in the future. But in this case, they weren't going to let that stand between them and getting Giancarlo signed for the long haul.
There was a lot of talk in advance that this would be potentially a very creative deal. And my talks with Joe Fusaro over the past weeks, all kinds of ideas of unusual and kind of creative things they might do. And one of the things that stands out, if the club maybe compromised a little on that, it seems like Stanton compromised a good bit on these first few years. He certainly obviously could have made a lot more money just going to arbitration. I know he talked about that some, but did his side view that as a fairly significant concession as far as getting this deal done?
Well, I think it's a concession, but at the same time, it speaks to what Giancarlo's main goal is here and what the team's main goal is here. They share one thing in common. They're both looking to win. They're both looking to win as quickly as possible and are looking to sustain that ability to win for as long as possible. So in basically taking $30 million over the next 3 years he could have made probably around $50 to $60 million over the next 3 years had he played it out in arbitration and into his first year of free agency. He's given the Marlins a lot of flexibility to go out and do more. And while there's a very good nucleus of talent here, when you look at certainly Stanton and Christian Yelich, Marcel Ozuna, Danny Echevarria, Jose Fernandez, other pitchers you go down the line with this team, the bottom line is that group, minus Jose for most last year, was still a 77-win team in 2014. So you've got to add some pieces still. And if Stanton was going to make $25, $30 million this year, you weren't going to have the flexibility to do that. By taking less in the next 3 years, Giancarlo has given the Marlins the opportunity and now basically the challenge to go out and spend that money elsewhere and further improve the ball club.
There's been a lot of talk over these past couple of days about the sort of getting him to buy in. And the way it's been framed is that's really while they were working on that for quite a while, that maybe really a lot did change in the last month with some conversations and some meetings. Do you think that really did happen sort of drastically within the last month, that they really sat down and convinced him, or was there also an element of him just kind of seeing what you and I and anybody sees, that this roster is kind of coming together and there's something interesting building here?
I think part one is what he saw over the course of the 2014 season. He liked the direction this team is headed in. He loves his manager, Mike Redmond. He's a big fan of Dan Jennings and Mike Hill at the top of the baseball operations department. He loves the young talent around him. But again, he knows we still need more. Having this talent is great. It's a great jumping off point. But we need more. And what they're able to convince him over the course of the last couple of weeks is they're committed now to going out and doing more, not just the long term, but in the short term as well. Because I think it's interesting, Matthew, when you look at the National League East right now, this is a division that for a long time seems very much out of reach, with the Nationals being as loaded as they are, with the Braves having been as consistent as they've been, with the Phillies having had that great run. But now the Phillies have taken a huge step back. The Braves seem to be coming back to the pack quite a bit. The Mets are surging. You know, the Nationals remain loaded, though they've got some major free agent questions to answer over the next two off seasons. And now the Marlins have a chance to jump right in there. It really is an opportunity for the Marlins and the Mets, as I look at it, two teams that haven't been at the top of the division, to make their move right now. Stanton sees that. The Marlins see that. And now we'll see how the rest of the offseason plays out.
What do you think they said to him? Because, again, I get the impression there have been conversations. It's not like they started out of nowhere. What do you think, and again, I realize to some extent this is speculation, but what do you think you can say to a guy to convince somebody who's expressed skepticism beyond what he sees in front of his face that, hey, this is real?
I think they said this is where our payroll is going to be in 2015. This is where it's going to be in the years to follow. And now we're committed to going out and trying to find a backup behind him, cleanup spot. Maybe an Adam LaRoche to play first base. It's been reported they've made a clear offer to LaRoche, who would be a great fit in this lineup, offensively and defensively. I think they told him we're going to look to add another arm to the starting rotation. With Jose coming back mid-season, that's about as good a mid-season pickup as anybody in baseball is going to make. But let's add another established arm to this rotation as well to go along with what you already have in Henderson Alvarez, Jared Cozart and Kohler and Eovaldi and the other pitchers we've seen who are still going to get more experience and get better as the years go on. So I think they've told him what their vision is for the next couple of years, for this offseason moving forward, and obviously bought into it.
Do you get the impression that the payroll will be, I mean, obviously it'll vary some by who's available, but there will be a fairly steady increase over the coming years as this, again, as the idea is this kind of comes together with some better clubs?
Well, I don't think there's any question that it's going to go up. As for what it's going to be specifically, I couldn't answer that question. That's answered above my pay grade. But I don't think there's any doubt about that. And I think they had to make sure that Giancarlo understood that and believed that. And again, this is why now after 6 years, he has that opt-out. And if they don't do what they're going to do, Giancarlo can walk away after 6 years. And, yeah, he'd be leaving a lot of money on the table, no doubt. But 6 years from now, he's still only just going into his age 31 season. And he'd still command a hefty salary in the free agent market. So he's got that protection after six seasons as well if things aren't going the way they tell him they expect him to go.
And one last thing on the deal that you brought up, the structure of that opt-out or player option or whatever you want to call it was really striking to me. That would be an enormous deal to walk away from. And I think we can all envision something in baseball changing over the next 6 years to where he is, in fact, conceivably at that point a $350 million over 8 year player. I mean, I don't think anybody could have seen what's happened over the last 10 years. But with that said, I had this thought that it's actually possible that he just plays out that, again, whatever you call it, opt out player option with the structure of that. It is conceivable that he's at a place in 6 years where the smartest thing is to stick around through the deal. I mean, did it strike you that way, or do you think it's at this point almost a foregone conclusion that even if he stays with the Marlins, that deal gets reworked somehow?
No, I don't think anything is a foregone conclusion at this point. You know, 2 weeks ago, nobody would have believed we'd be sitting here talking about 13 years and $325 million. 5 years ago, nobody thought we'd be talking about a $300-plus million contract. So who knows where the economics of the game are going to take us over the next 6 years. But I think it's going to play out on the field more than in the business offices for Stanton over the next 6 years. Is this team going to continue to make the commitment to winning? Is it going to win? Is he going to love his time here? Is he going to raise World Series trophies in Miami? If he does that, to me, everything else takes care of itself. If he's not happy with the direction of the team after 6 years, yeah, he can walk away. But, you know, it's easy to say it's not about the money when you've just signed a $325 million contract, but you really believe it and listen to Giancarlo talk yesterday. And look, we've got to know him over the last 5 years. This guy wants to win. He's got the burning desire to work and to do whatever it takes to win, to lift everybody up around him. And I really do believe, as silly as it sounds to say, it's about much more than the years. It's about much more than the money. This guy just wants to win. And to me, the most striking thing he said in the press conference yesterday was, he said, people think I just won the lottery. He said, no, when you win the lottery, you quit your job, you move wherever you want to move, and that's it, and you enjoy the rest of your life. For me, this isn't the end. This is just the beginning. The work now is just beginning. The expectations are just now beginning. And this is really where it launches for Giancarlo and this team. So, you know, we'll see how the next 6 years play out. We all know 6 years is a long time. A lot can happen between now and then. There are going to be some ups. There are going to be some downs. But, you know, in the meantime, let's enjoy the ride.
And you mentioned Adam LaRoche, who is a name that does seem to be out there and does seem, like you know, to be kind of an interesting fit. Beyond him, what do you think happens between now and January or February or March or whenever it all gets done to turn this club from an interesting right on the fringe of contention club to a team that I think, as they wish to do, legitimately contends for a playoff spot in 2015?
I think one big bat is critical, and LaRoche is the kind of player who fills that bill. I think he'd be a nice number four hitter behind Giancarlo. I think when you look at all the doubles he's hit over the course of his career, he's swinging the bat very well in Marlins Park. What he brings defensively lifts the rest of the infield as well. It's been a long time, probably all the way back to the days of Derek Lee, since the Marlins have had an elite defensive first baseman, and that makes a big difference. I think you can still look to add more offense, though. Second base is a position where the Marlins have not gotten a lot of production in recent years. And the free agent market's not great at second base. Maybe you swing a trade there. And one of the things that I began to sense really yesterday in listening to Michael Hill and Dan Jennings and others talk is, whereas in the past the Marlins have been very reluctant to part with any of their upper-level pitching prospects, they may now, as they move more into a win-now mode, be willing to talk about making a deal that would include one of those upper-level pitching prospects if it could bring back potentially a second baseman, another big bat somewhere. And I also do think they're going to make every effort to bring in at least one more starting pitcher, somebody with a pretty good track record who's going to log 200 innings for you or somewhere close to that and give you a good chance to win every 5 days, take some of the pressure off some of the younger developing pitchers in this rotation, who in some cases have already accomplished quite a bit at the big league level, and also buy a little bit of time until Jose Fernandez comes back, because when you add Jose to this rotation in June or July, if he's anywhere near what he was before the Tommy John surgery, that's a huge, huge addition.
Absolutely. Well, Glenn Geffner, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Philadelphia Phillies with MLB.com's Phillies beat reporter, Todd Zalecki. Todd, it's been, as far as actual transactions, a fairly quiet stretch here for the Phillies. I don't think anybody necessarily expects that to continue. One thing that strikes me as interesting is it, for all the talk that the Phillies were maybe the favorites on Yasmani Tomas, we're now hearing some rumblings that maybe that's a little less true. What's your read on where things stand right now with the Phillies and Tomas?
Yeah, I right now, if I had to put money on it, I would say it's not going to happen. From what I understand, you know, they backed off in a little bit. I think what's going on is there's just kind of a difference of opinion in the organization. There are some people that really think this guy is going to be a good hitter in the big leagues, and there are some people that aren't as convinced. And those people then look at the price tag for Tomas, which I don't think it's going to hit the $100 million mark. But even if it's $80, $90 million, I think it gives enough people in the organization pause that they just don't feel comfortable with it. And it's really an interesting kind of development, because this is an organization that is desperately trying to get younger, desperately trying to find power bats, and they don't really have anybody in the organization that looks, plays, has the potential of a Yasmani Tomas. So it made, for a lot of reasons, it made tons of sense for them to go out and sign this guy, but as of this moment, I would say it's unlikely. Now, that could change. The right people get convinced. Enough people change their minds. The price tag comes down low enough. You make one phone call, boom, a deal is done. But as it stands right now, like I said, it just doesn't seem like it's going to get there.
I guess that's kind of what I'm wondering is for an organization in their position, aren't you more likely to regret missing out on the guy than paying him 15 a year even? I mean, I realize that's almost hard to fathom, but it's kind of the way baseball is right now. It seems like, do you think it's fair to say that you're more likely to regret not getting the guy than giving him the contract?
Yeah, I think so. If this guy pans out, he's 24. So even if you sign him to a 7-year, $90 million deal, if he pans out, that is going to be a huge bargain to get a guy, a power hitter, corner outfielder in his prime. And, so I think for a lot of reasons, I think it's worth taking a shot. And, just because Yasiel Puig and Jose Abreu and Cespedes have been very good players coming out of Cuba doesn't necessarily mean that Tomas is. That's something that Ruben Amaro Jr. said last week at the GM meetings. But on the other hand, if you're gonna roll the dice on somebody, roll the dice on the 24-year-old, power hitter. That'd be the guy I'd roll the dice on rather than the 31-year-old power hitter.
Sure. And so given that, I mean, we're dealing with smart people here, and we're dealing with people who have made a lot of decisions. They can surely look at that as well as we can. So given that, what are their worries? What are their concerns as they reevaluate what, again, had seemed to be a pretty significant amount of interest?
I think it's a few things. One is how good of a defensive player is he going to be, but I think the biggest one is, or I should say the two biggest ones are the money, and I've heard some rumblings that, what kind of shape is this guy going to be in? I guess there's been a little bit of concern of his conditioning and whatnot. So those two types of things, if he's 24-year-old and you might be going, if he's 24 years old with some maybe a potential conditioning issue, is this going to be something that could become a problem down the road? But the good news about a 24-year-old guy is he's still 24 years old. he's still maybe athletic enough and young enough to maybe battle those types of things. Look at Pablo Sandoval. He doesn't exactly have a great baseball body, but he's turned out to be a heck of a hitter, and he's probably going to get a big contract, and he's 4 years older than Tomas is. So I don't know if they're thinking too much into that or looking too much into that, but that seems to be that kind of combination of things, conditioning, the money involved, and maybe what kind of position or defense he'll play seems to be kind of like the general factor, and the Phillies kind of maybe backing away or losing a little bit of interest in Tomas.
as far as what they have done so far, some small moves, but it seemed like some mildly interesting names coming in on minor league deals. Of the guys they have brought in on minor league deals so far, is there anybody that catches your eye, anybody you think might sort of be an intriguing piece or an intriguing contributor to this organization?
I think the most intriguing piece is just Jeff Francoeur, and really just the number of outfielders they brought in general. But I think of their first 10 non-roster guys or 9 non-roster guys that they have announced, I believe 5 or 6 were outfielders. And that is a clear indication that this team, to me, expects to be busy with their outfielders this offseason, trading Marlon Byrd, maybe trading Dominic Brown or Ben Revere if the right price comes along. But they just really lacked a lot of depth in the minor league system last season. So when they had injuries and whatnot, they really didn't have any options to call people up. So I think what they're trying to do right now is just stockpile some names. Nobody, I think, that is going to become a huge factor in next season's team, but just some guys that could contribute a little bit and just some guys that could offer them more depth, because while they don't expect to necessarily be a competitive team next season, they at least want to put some players on the field that deserve to be there.
There's been – you had a piece this week in the wake of some of the other dealings that went on and noted some of the ways that could affect the Phillies, and I thought one of the really interesting names was Carlos Ruiz, because as much as we have talked about Hamels, Lee, Utley, Rollins, Howard as potential trade options, one guy it seems like doesn't come up as much is Ruiz, and yet – with Russell Martin going to a place he wasn't expected to go, you look at the Cubs as a team that presumably are looking for catching. Do you think that Ruiz is maybe a potential trade target for some club? Do you think he's a guy that we might ought to be mentioning more along with the other names?
I definitely think that he should be mentioned more. It's surprising that he has not been mentioned more. You're right, though. You hear a lot about Hamels, Howard, and Marlon Byrd, Papelbon, those types of guys. And then you don't really hear much about Ruiz, but I believe that there is some interest in Ruiz. He's got 2 years and $17.5 million left on his deal. Now, I don't know how teams are going to look at that. Is that too much money? Is that a decent amount of money in terms of a commitment? He's been on the disabled list each of the previous 6 seasons, but you look at his offensive production, his career OPS, is in line with Miguel Montero's. He's better acknowledged to be better defensively than Deionor Navarro from the Blue Jays, who might be available now. So he's a guy to definitely, I think, to keep an eye on. The Phillies have made it clear they're willing to trade anybody on their roster. They don't really have a backup option for Carlos Ruiz at catcher, but I don't think that they will think twice about trading him if they can get something decent for him in return.
And now for the obligatory portion of our program, where do things stand as far as some of the bigger names, as far as interest in Hamels, in Utley, in Rollins?
Well, Utley and Rollins, right as it stands right now, there's been no indication that either of those players, despite the fact that the Phillies have been trying to beat a steady drum that we are rebuilding, we're not going to try to compete next year or contend, I think, for a World Series next year. Neither of those guys have given any indication that they're willing to waive their no-trade clauses. So as it stands right now, I would bet that those guys are back with the Phillies in spring training. Ryan Howard, they're still working hard to try to move him. But the fact remains is that his numbers are way down. He's 35 years old, and he's owed $60 million over the next 2 years, which includes a $10 million buyout on the club option. So the Phillies are going to have to eat a ton of money on him. Now that Billy Butler just signed with the A's, you're hearing could Howard be a possible fit in Kansas City? The Kansas City Royals have been mentioned before. It's possible, but I think it depends how much money the Phillies are willing to eat. And in terms of Cole Hamels, I get the feeling that before he is traded, some other teams want to see what kind of progress they make on a John Lester or a Max Scherzer or James Shields, that type of thing. And Ruben Amaro seemed to indicate that last week as well, too, that some of these free agents might need to fall off the board before a team gets really serious and really bears down on Cole Hamels. Now, again, I always say this, but everything can change with one phone call. So if the Phillies are talking to the Red Sox, which they have been, and the Red Sox agree to maybe put in a player that they've been reluctant to put in, then maybe that deal gets done before some of these guys sign. But the indications are right now that the Phillies expect some of these other free agents to drop off the board first before they can maybe move a guy like Cole Hamels.
And what about College Game Day superstar Jonathan Papelbon? Does he still seem like maybe the guy that it might be easiest to find a taker for?
Well, yeah, it's possible. Those teams that are looking for a closer, and maybe they don't get David Robertson if he re-signs with the Yankees, then you would think so. I know there are a lot of issues, you know, do you want to bring the guy in the clubhouse? What kind of clubhouse guy is he? But, you know, maybe a team like the Tigers that battled bullpen issues all last year, or another team that has had some bullpen issues might say, you know what, the guy is still pitching at a high level. We'll pursue him and take him off their hands. I think Marlon Byrd is a guy that has gotten a lot of interest this offseason, and he's another guy that could be moved. So I still think they're going to make some trades. I still think they're going to move some guys. Maybe it's not going to be as many as some people thought, but I think if they're serious about rebuilding, which they are, some of these guys are going to have to move at some point.
All right. Well, Todd Zielecki, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras, and thanks, everybody, for listening.
Visit the official online shop of Major League Baseball at MLB.com/shop for the largest selection of authentic caps, T-shirts, jerseys, hoodies, collectibles, and more. Get your gear straight from the source, the MLB.com shop.